Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Take it from us. Welcome into our program for another week. I hope you're going okay. I hope you've done the best that you can in the last few days or so. If you want to reach out to us, please do. Do that via our website, our new website, takeitfromusradio.org. Shorten that down, TIFURadio.org. You can leave us a note. Also on there, you'll find all of our radio programs. If you ever miss one for whatever reason, you can find it there. We've got podcasts up there now as well and some blogs. Some health-related blogs as well. So please check out our website and get in touch. Let us know how you're going. TIFURadio.org. That's the way to do that. I went to a friend's 40th on the weekend. She's a dear friend of mine. We've been friends for a number of years. On any other weekend, if it was for somebody else, I might not have gone because I could have probably have done with just a night at home relaxing on the couch after a busy week. But I decided to go because I knew that if I went, I'd enjoy myself. So my partner Laura and I, we jumped on into a cab with some friends and off we went. We had a pretty good night, but I tell you what, often now where I go in my role as a health coach, I get asked for advice quite a lot, or people at least want my thoughts on health and well-being and what is it that I do to look after myself. And I think people are curious. And then people also, once they ask a question or two, will probably tell me a lot about what they're doing. So I do get asked for a lot of thoughts around the stuff, and I'm always obliging and happy to talk about it because I think it's important to do so. And I've really appreciated the fact that a lot of people actually do want to have a chat about how they're going, whether it be their physical health or their mental well-being. And look, we know it's not a great secret. We know that the two go together. If you look after your body, you're looking after your brain, and vice versa. I ended up having three meaningful conversations on Saturday night, and all of them were around health and family and wanting to change. In my experience, we all want positive change in our lives. We do. But a lot of us struggle to change. So there's a difference there. So a lot of us struggle to make the changes that we know that we really want to be making. In theory, behavioral change is relatively easy. Some people find it real easy. In reality, it can be pretty damn challenging for people. It can be tough because a lot of people just don't know where to really start. But I came away on the weekend having admiration for all of the people that I talked to because they are wanting to give something a crack. And I ended up having a chat out on the road outside of the bar that we were at, and I hadn't had much alcohol at all, so I was all good to go. And I just sat there listening to a guy that I know relatively well, and he was asking me what it is that I do to look after myself. And by the way, I don't have all of the answers. I have ups and downs. I get things wrong. I still do dumb things and go, man, I know better than that, you know. But what I said to him was, I know what does work, and that is to invest time in myself. I really value that now. And that was only pointed out to me recently, you know, within the last year or so, that if you don't make the time for yourself, then other people will suffer because of that. It's not selfish. It really isn't to make the time to go for a walk or to make the time to do a meditation or to tell the kids, look, I just need 20 or 30 minutes to myself. I want to close my eyes. That's not being selfish. It's actually the opposite. Because if you look after yourself and if you throw the time into your own well-being, the personal well-being, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, whatever it is, you will have more energy to give to others. And I know this is true. It took me a little while to figure it out for me, but I know that it is true. If I look after myself, I have more energy and enthusiasm to be around the people in my life that I really love and the people in my life that I want to take care of and look after. I cannot take care of them if I don't take care of myself. So I know that to be true. And I think the penny dropped for him that, yeah, he hasn't looked after himself well enough. Because what also happens, of course, in times of high stress and anxiety and worry and fear and trauma, and a lot of us have been through a lot of that recently, is that our well-being goes to the bottom. And really what should happen is that our well-being should get bumped right up in a time of crisis. If ever there's a time in your life that you need to be looking after yourself, it's when times are tough. But what happens, of course, is the opposite happens a lot of the time, sadly. And it's kind of like a failing of our species, isn't it? Hey, you know, we've all been guilty of it. I know I have. Man, I know I've let myself down many times. But you get back up and you try again. So I came away from my friend's party feeling kind of hopeful. I'm really glad that I went, because I came away hopeful because these really neat people that I like, who I got to speak to, they are being brave. They really are. And they're looking inside themselves to get healthier. You know, one guy wants to try and reduce alcohol big time. Another wants to try and cut out sugar. And then some friends of mine are looking to basically start a health kick, eat good food and start to exercise a little bit more. And they are a little bit daunted and they're a little bit scared, but they're ready to go. And we know also with behavioural change models that if someone isn't ready to make change, it's very, very hard to force them to do it. The person has to be ready themselves. There has to be a trigger to get them to go. And I saw that up close on Saturday. Would have been great to have one of those conversations, but I felt very fortunate to have three on the same night. And so I wish everyone all the very best. They're starting out. It's the most challenging part, but they're all prepared to give it a crack. So good for them. I came away feeling inspired after the weekend. Well, our first guest on Take It From Us today is AJ Crawshaw. AJ is a musician whose life has been affected by a lot of mental illness, not just for himself, but for people very close to him. And he's talked before about struggling with serious depression. AJ talks openly about his life, and he even wrote a song titled Life's for the Living. Really looking forward to bringing you that track very shortly on Take It From Us. But first, let's hear about AJ and how he's doing. AJ, it's so good of you to join us on our program. How are you? Welcome in.
Yeah, I've been doing really good, thanks. Last kind of 5 or so years, it's been a really good upward trajectory in terms of like my mental health. But you've definitely been in the wars before that. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and what was it that had you in the wars?
So a couple of things, I guess, and it's always interesting to look back post, right? Like you have a bit more insight when you reflect after you've been through a thing. When you're in the thing, it's really hard to figure out what it is. So I've suffered on and off with severe mental health, like specifically depression was the big one for me. That got me to a really, really dark place a number of years ago. I was at the limit, at the threshold, at death's door with it, and it's actually hard thinking back on that. Every time, right? So with that at that time, I was mercifully I was able to with my family's help, they identified and picked up that I was in a really low space, and I confessed that I'd had thoughts about ending it, and that I had a plan for how, you know, so it was a good and timely discussion, and they got me into some therapy and onto some medication, and the medication kept on tracking up and up and up because I was actually quite bad, like it was quite a deep and severe depression, until eventually I got to a kind of stable but very kind of groggy state, I would say. With the therapy, like that ongoing therapy, over a period of 2 years, I think, I was able to start tapering off. It was a really intense period, and it was just like a day-by-day thing, you know, like I'm going to get through this day, you know, I'm going to get through this moment sometimes, you know. Yeah.
So you had to start small and cling on to the small things.
Oh, it's moment by moment, yeah. Like in the moment, it's just deciding that I'm going to keep on, you know. I think it really does come down to that. I think there can be a lot of misconception about depression or mental health where people are like, oh, if you just try harder, you know, like you'll pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you come right. I mean, you're trying with everything you've got in that moment to hang on. And I think a large part of the battle, at least for me, because it'll be different for everyone, was that I did hang on, you know, like I hung on for long enough so that eventually things started to change, because life isn't static, you know, like things do come and go and your life has these ups and downs, these peaks and these troughs. But when I kind of like, after a length of time of sticking in there and also having people come around me to help, life did actually change and it did progressively get better. But in the moment, all you can see is that you feel so crap that you just want everything to go. And depression is this horrible illness too, right? Because it robs you of your perspective on that. Like, you're not like, oh, if I just hold on, it'll be fine. You're more like, at the moment, everything's terrible and it's hopeless, you know? And you sometimes you don't even know why you're holding on. But yeah. If that could be a message of hope from me, from someone who's been through it, yeah, it did change. Like, it does actually get better. There is, like, a light at the end of the tunnel. And life isn't static. It's constantly changing and constantly in flux. Like, yeah, things affect us in the moment, but then 5 years later, who knows where you'll be, you know?
So how were you able to think clearly enough, with enough clarity, to hang in there and hang in the fight, when chances are you weren't able to think as clearly as you would ordinarily be because of the mental exhaustion and the sheer toll that had taken on you?
That's a really great question, eh? So I had a couple of anchors, and I think those anchors are really useful in those fights, in those moments. So one was my daughter. Like, I couldn't escape the idea of what kind of damage I might do to her long term. So as the people that I loved, that I was like, I love them more than my own desire to, you know, to end it. Even if it's suffering and even if it's long-term suffering, I'm going to hold on for as long as I can because I love these people so much that I don't want them to get hurt, right? So that was a big appeal to me. And then other times it would just be like dumb stuff like distraction. Like I'd be like, I'm feeling really awful right now. I'm going to just do something else, you know? Like in those moments, it's like switching your focus and not ruminating, like trying to get out of the rumination. But the anchors for me were definitely my daughter. And the other thing that surprised me, actually, another big anchor. So the two anchors were family. And then the other one was, for me, my faith. Like I found, because I'm a Christian, I found at the bottom of it, it wasn't so much the fear of hell from suicide or something like that. It wasn't this kind of theological issues or whatever that grounded me. It was more like at the bottom of it, I found that I still had faith even when I felt hopeless, which surprised me. And then I was like, well, I guess God's here with me in it. And so it was this deep sense of like drawing from that spiritual connection that I can, you know, he's with me in it. He might not fix everything straight away, but at least I've got someone journeying with me. Like at least I've got, you know, God with me here. And same with my family. You could say those two things too, like, you know, about my family as well. At least I've got people journeying with me here. And so that could be a real anchor for me. So I found those two things. And then the distractions or the things that eventually the distractions ended up being good habits. So like it was the kinds of things you distracted yourself with that really mattered. Like I'd go for a run, you know, and that would help because I was just running, you know, like and that was a thing that I could somehow do, or it might be like, so exercise became a good distraction. I'll pick up my guitar and write a really depressing song. But at least it was like, you know, oh, I'm processing this. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're getting your thoughts out of your head. I mean, I guess for you, picking up a guitar is getting those thoughts and feelings out of your brain. It's probably similar to, say, me when I journal or write things. Just so to get them on paper can make a huge difference because I know when I do that, AJ, I've distanced myself from they're just thoughts, they're just feelings. I'm not them. So I've distanced them from me by getting them down. Is it like that for you when you're writing your music?
Yeah, and I actually figured out recently. So I do, like, I'm a musician by trade. That's what I do, and I run a music school and a bunch of other things around that. But I figured that I was trying to figure out, am I a musician because I just, you know, like, this is what I thought was cool, or was something I wanted to do, or why do I write music? Why do I do it? And recently I figured out, you know what, I will write songs just because this is actually my genuine way of processing things. So I need time just to write music. And if it wasn't writing music, it would probably be journaling or painting or something. But it would be that creative process allows me to get what I call like a niggle in my soul, allows me to kind of expand on that. And then once that niggle, like, it's kind of like a bit of sand for an oyster, right, that creates the pearl. Like, it's like that. There's something that's just gritting. And I need to kind of figure it out, work it through, and then through birthing that, that's when I'll create like a song. And that's where it all kind of comes from. And yeah, it's definitely processing. It's emotional processing. So yeah, very similar to journaling, just done through that creative outlet.
Because we can't trust our feelings, can we? Or our thoughts, really.
Well, sometimes you can't, eh? Yeah. Yeah. And so having a process, maybe it is that slowing it down, right, so that you can evaluate what they are. Like, maybe it's that, maybe the creative process actually kind of allows you to kind of tease out really what it is, you know? I think it might be something like that. Yeah.
Did you, when you spoke out, and it was great for you to have an intervention of some sorts from your family and friends, and they were able to spot, they knew you well enough to spot some things and to help. Was that a relief to go, wow, I'm not in this alone now? Or did it still take courage to speak up and to open up?
It still took courage. Yeah. Like, there's those moments where you go, am I going to be honest? Because part of you is like, you want to keep that hidden. Because from my perspective, it was like, things won't change. You know, at that time, my view then was things won't change. Things are only going to get worse and I can't see a way out, right? And so, but I was still like, you know what, even if I'm wrong, like, what if I'm wrong about that? Even like, maybe there's only a 20% chance I'm wrong about that, right? This is how tricked you get by your own mind, right? But I was like, maybe if there's only a 20, let's just see, you know. Might as well just see if I was wrong, right? And so it was more like that, but the courage was to go, well, I'll give it another crack, I guess. Yeah, I'll give another crack at trying to get out of this hole.
Yeah. And tell us about the coping mechanisms now you use and the tools that you've discovered. You mentioned exercise, but I know that there are other things that you do now that are lifestyle choices that you lean into.
Yeah, actually, I have a daily habits to function well as a human list.
So, really?
Yeah, I do. Is this specific? And I try to tick them off every day. Yeah.
Okay.
So there you go. So this is something I've given a lot of thought and effort towards. And these things do work for me and help me stay level. Like, anyone listening can kind of adapt them for themselves or whatever. But so every morning I get up and I try and find something that I can be grateful for, and I keep a gratitude journal. So I'm like, and it just has to be one thing. This morning it was, cause I've been off sick work for a week. I was like, I'm grateful I can get back to being busy and doing things I enjoy. Right. Like, it's that simple, like, just pick on one thing that was a positive, and that kind of sets your brain right. And I find that the habit of kind of like focusing down on that will kind of gravitate my day towards positivity. And then I double down on that, actually. So the first thing is something I'm grateful for. And the second thing, I kind of go, and again, I write it down. I'll sit and have a pray after reading the Bible or think. And then I'm like, okay, who's someone I can bless? Or what's something good I can do in the world today? And so the habit of like trying to lean myself outwards, that again gets me out of my own rumination and my own head towards going out. So those two things of, what am I grateful for? What's happened or what's happening that's awesome? And then two, how can I bring joy and good to other people's lives today? And so just leaning out towards something. And those two things set my track really well. And then it'll be drop the kids at school, you know, do all the mundane things or whatever. And then I try and exercise straight after. That's my time. I work at the other end of the day. So I'm like, okay, let's go exercise. Today I went to the gym, worked on some shoulder stuff. like it's or go for a run. I find that running is like EMDR for me. Like, you know, you get the left right thing going, it can help you process stuff, anything physical, and it just creates this low key buildup of good dopamine in your head. I find so like I get the good feels as a real low key effect. You don't feel it till after 3 weeks or something, but if you do it daily, it stacks, and then eventually you're like, actually, things are better than they were when I wasn't, you know, wasn't exercising. And then I try and get some point in every day, I try and do some kind of creating or reflecting. And then the other one that I have done here is some point every day is I try and make connection with people I care about. And so, yeah,
That's a pretty impressive list. And I'm totally with you on gratitude. I do exactly what you do. And it only has to be one thing every day. I think people get overwhelmed when they think, I've got to do five, I've got to do 10. Nah, just do one. And all of a sudden, after 7 days, you've got seven things in your journal that you're grateful for, and go back and reread them. That's what I do.
Yeah, reread them. And that's why that's the power of a journal. You can go and you can get stack over time. You're like, oh, cool. And then the other thing I do at the end of the day is I'll go, what did I do that was successful today? So I'll like try and write something down at the end of the day where I'm like, oh, where was something I actually did? Okay, I ticked off going to the gym. Sometimes it's that. Like sometimes I get up and I'm like, I'm grateful I can have a coffee. Like it's not like, you know, sometimes you're stretching. But it's all good because it does stack up. Yeah. Like, you know what, that's pretty good that I can have a coffee. And you're like, it is pretty good that I actually followed through on that today. You know, and that builds this narrative around your life of like, because I think it's that ongoing narrative, right, of like, I'm somebody who has lots of good things in my life. That's what you're reflecting on. And I'm somebody who was successful a lot. That's the kinds of things that you end up building into your own story. And that again, builds courage and confidence and builds like this perspective on yourself, which then you take into the world. And then that feeds its own self, right? Then people start to view you that way. They start to view you as a happy, grateful person. And they start to view you as somebody who's trying to bring good into the world and is successful at things, because that's what you're telling yourself, you know? And that stacks. It starts getting a good stack. If rumination is a bad stack, you know, those kind of habits create a good stack, you know?
Incremental gains. And we know, don't we, that the more we focus on the good things in our lives, we there's no room to focus on the negative stuff. We can't be doing two things at once. So I'm loving this list that you've given us. Do you eat well? Is that something you focus on, good food?
I try and do like I believe in a diet you can maintain. So I eat like 80% good most of the time and then 20%, you know, enjoying foods, right? Like, and I think that kind of balance is something I can do. So I can eat pretty clean Monday to Friday. On the weekends, I can have ice creams with my kids. On Sundays, we have like Sundays, you know. But that way I'm kind of like, I still have food I enjoy in my life, but most of the time I'm eating pretty clean. Yeah. So I think that's how I kind of manage that. But, yeah, most of the time it's like, you know, veggies and fruits and cereals and, you know, good things, right? So that's the majority of my diet, and I find that really helps.
Yeah. Take it from us. We're talking with AJ Crawshaw on our program. Can you tell us about please don't give us any specifics here, but I know that you took a call from a friend a little while ago, and that gave you a different perspective too on mental well-being, because you were a person in a position to help.
And for anyone listening and thinking my list sounds insurmountable, it would have been insurmountable for me a couple of years ago, right? Like, but it just built one thing new into your life and make that happen. I got a call from my best friend actually, and he was going through like a really rough spell. And I actually had a dream the night before, and then he starts telling me about how he's feeling the next day. And like, he's like, oh, it feels like I've been on the precipice. My heart's been on the ledge. I'm like, dude, like, I just had this dream about this. Like, and so it just really lined up. It was one of those kind of magical moments. And it was, but where the connection point was, I think that was really critical inside of that, was that like, he felt he could reach out to me because he knew I'd been through it. And so that was what enabled the conversation to take place. And he was like, I'm feeling really suicidal, you know? And I'm like, oh, dude, I was around there, you know? I was around there straight away. And we were like, I was talking and we were like, do I need to call somebody else? You know, where are things at? We should let your wife know, you know? which we did, and he did slowly come right. But the thing was, in having the conversation, it kind of, I think partly when you have the conversation, it defangs the thing. It takes the teeth out of it. Like, in that moment, it gets rid of the bite. And so just him being brave enough to say, and then us being able to have that conversation fairly immediately, it kind of took the teeth out of it for him. And so then we were able to start, over time, talking about his mental well-being and helping him kind of get more on top. And now he's joined me at the gym, and he's, you know, yeah, and he's got some of his own good daily habits and that kind of thing. But, yeah, if you are feeling that way, man, I just reach out and talk to somebody. Sometimes that's, like, enough. And then you're having that good encouragement over time. That I think there's a resiliency study I read that said something like the biggest determiner of those who kind of, like, manage to have, show those traits of resiliency over time is the connections that they have in their life. So it's how connected you are to people, and trying to build those connections and lean on those connections can really make a difference when you're in that deep-seated pain. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and we know connection's just hugely influential, and people who are socially isolated, their health suffers, and physically, mentally, emotionally, everything starts to fall away if they're emotionally isolated. So you were there for your mate.
Yeah.
What was that like for you to go through that and be able to share some of your own experience to one of your best buddies and get them through?
I think I don't want to undersell this, and I don't want to oversell it in the wrong way either. I think, but what I do think is it adds meaning to the suffering you've been through yourself. Like, in that moment, it feels like, oh, thank God I can repurpose some of this. It's not like you're grateful for having gone through it, but it's more along the lines of, like, now I've gained some wisdom, and that adds a layer of meaning into my own existence, right, where I can now share that with others. And that is so good, being able to be in a place where you can do that on the other end. So that's great to have seesawed all the way up there. And I think for him in turn, he's done that for me, you know, at points for me as well. Like when I've had a slump, he's been right there. And that's what I mean by that resiliency in that relationship. You know, like having that, being able to have those open conversations is just magic. And it gives meaning to each other's lives. Yeah.
It was lovely too that you mentioned, I know you've got two kids, but your daughter at the time a few years ago, and I'm a dad of two. I've got younger kids, and man, they can just zap your energy and take everything from you. But my God, what about those moments when you feel like you've got nothing to give and your energy levels are so low, and somehow these little magic people uplift without even trying, they wouldn't even know what they're doing, they can lift you up sky high just in the space of 5 seconds. Isn't that amazing?
It's incredible. Like so often you hear parents groan about their kids, right? But the thing that no one ever says out loud, which we all should say out loud, is, man, these little people add meaning to your life, and man, they add joy. And yeah, they can be tedious, and yeah, they can be all those, you know, like, are we there yet? Over and over again, or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
But the smiles and the, oh, Dad, I love you, or the, like, cuddle they give you, or the, like, them laughing at each other, you know, like, there's just all these magic moments, and you go, oh, wow, like, this is so great to watch another person grow and flourish, and I'm part of that. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, man.
I think AJ, what it comes down to is the unconditional love that a child shows his parents is unsurpassed. It's unconditional, isn't it? They're so little, they're so young, to not even be aware of realize what they're doing and the impact they're having on other people. All it is love, and they show it in funny ways at times, but yeah, we know that it's there. Hey.
Yeah, and they're always reaching out, hey?
Yeah, they know how to reach out, don't they? That is for sure. Well, look, AJ, it's been absolutely lovely to have you on the program, and thanks for being so courageous, I think, and to have done what you've done, and to also share your story and to open up and talk to us and to talk to our listeners about, you know, on the days that we are low, we can just hang in there and reach out and do our best to look after ourselves. There is a lot of life to live, and the future can be bright and prosperous for all of us. And that's really the message in your song that you released in 2018 called Life's for the Living.
Yeah,
we will play this very shortly. Can you tell us a little bit about the song and why this is so special for you?
So this was the song I wrote for my friend who, after he contacted me and told me about, you know, how he was feeling off the back end of the dream I had the night before, us having this conversation, and I really thought about it afterwards, and after I had the conversation, and I was like, you know what, like, what is it that actually did get me through? And I wanted to chuck that in the chorus, and I wanted to write the, you know, the imagery that I saw in the dream down, and some of the feelings that he expressed, and some of the feelings I know. And so the pre-chorus kind of goes, nobody knows it better than one who's seen the abyss, and nobody said it better to me than like this. Because these aren't lessons I came up with, these are things passed on to me too, right? And here's the chorus, the lyrics. So, life's for the living and we're not dead. We've got so much more living to do left yet. Just because you can't see it, don't mean it's not there. Hold on, get help, take care. And if there's like, there's one thing I could, or three things I want to say today that people could take away is, hold on, life's not static, it can change. Get help, reach out, be brave, be courageous, talk to people about what you're going through, and take care of yourself. Set up some good habits, set up some things that are going to give you resiliency. Yeah. So hold on, get help, take care. Yeah. I'd love that message to get out everywhere.
Well, the message is in the song. AJ, thank you so much for joining us on our program. Introduce your song for us. We'll play it right now.
All right. This is Life's for the Living by the AJ Caushal Band. Thanks for having me.
AJ Crawshaw Band. Eh? Life's for the Living on Take It From Us. Hope you enjoyed that track. Higher Ground Drug Rehabilitation Trust operates a treatment program for pregnant women who are addicted to drugs. It's a program that allows the women to stay close to their young children. The name of the program is Te Whare Taonga, and the Clinical Operations Manager for Higher Ground is Marie Matthews. Marie is joining us on Take It From Us today. Also is Gemma, who is with us. Gemma is a young mum who is about to graduate the program. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Marie, there's a lot to cover off today, and we're very interested to hear Gemma's story because it is quite inspiring. Can you just start for us and tell our listeners about the program that you're running and the goals behind it?
Sure. So I work for Higher Ground Drug Rehabilitation. So we're residential treatment for those who suffer from severe addiction issues to substances. So we have opened a new program called Te Whare Taonga, which is a woman's only program. I think we started thinking about this program about 5 years ago, realising that was a real gap out there for wahine who were hapu or who had little ones. You know, it's difficult for them to come into treatment. It's also difficult for them to access services when they are pregnant. There's a lot of shame around that and fear that they'll, you know, lose their children if they are honest about their addiction issues. You know, there's a lot of barriers for them. So we opened this program. It's a 6-month residential program. And it's based on the first 1,000 days of a pepe's life. Basically. That's the most vulnerable kind of stage. And, you know, we're based on attachment theory, and those times is really important for bonding and things like that. So that's what it's about. We opened it in January last year. We're in partnership with Oranga Tamariki. I think, you know, they want to do something different as well and prevent pepes being uplifted from their mothers. So it's working really well as a partnership together. You know, it gives wahine opportunity to come into treatment, work on their substance abuse issues, learn how to parent in a healthy way, in a safe environment with other women living in this community together. Yeah. Mm.
And you've had a number of graduates, and Gemma's not far away from joining them. Is that right?
That's right. She'll be our fifth one. All going well, eh, Gemma?
Yep.
And Gemma, what's the best part of that for you?
The best part of it is, like, doing therapeutic work and, like, getting to know my feelings and stuff, having my baby with me, and, like, just being clean.
What can you tell us about this program and the impact that it's had on your life and also your babies?
For myself, it has saved my life as well as my babies. Like, I've got to do so much things in Te Whare Taonga. I got to do a burial ceremony for my mum, and I've learned to deal with my emotions, and I'm just getting to know them as well as my baby and a safe space, I suppose. Yeah.
So you're getting to know your emotions. Are you getting in touch with your inner being, with yourself throughout the program?
Yeah.
Marie, what do you see in Gemma from, you know, where Gemma was when she arrived and where she is now?
Yeah, well, I saw Gemma initially at the beginning living in chaos, which is quite common for those in active addiction. Her daughter had been uplifted from her care. She was very desperate, you know, not only to get well for herself, but to have her daughter in her care. I think it's very distressing when you lose custody and autonomy over your children and as a mother. But I think, you know, that was done because it was unsafe, the situation. So I think, you know, Gemma was very frightened when she first came in. She probably really struggled initially to settle. There's lots of rules and structure and processes in place, the same as we do in our adult program, because we're teaching routine and, you know, there's lots of rules which pertain to safety in the community. I think Gemma struggled initially because she didn't have her daughter with her, but we wanted her to settle for a few weeks and see how she was, then have visits, and then her daughter joined her and has been ever since. So I think that that was a real anchoring thing for Gemma when her daughter came to the whare and joined her there. And I've just seen them both really thrive. Her daughter's third birthday is today. So we're celebrating her, which
great.
Is so lovely. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the kids become a part of the community as well. You know, they form a real attachment to there, and I think she's very settled, Gemma's daughter, and she's doing really well, right?
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, yeah. And I've seen Gemma get in touch with her vulnerability, which I think something that is masked so much with using substances, I think a lot of people use to hide those feelings of pain, feelings of trauma. And so once you take the drugs away, you're left with all of these feelings that have been pent up for so long. And I think being in a therapeutic environment like Te Whare Tonga, you can really safely get in touch with that stuff. You know, Gemma lost her mum when she was 11. And I think the burial ceremony she talked about is, you know, we send our whai ora to Noho Marae, stay while they're in treatment, so they get an idea of what happens on Marae. And, you know, she was able to write a therapeutic letter to her mother around her grief and the impact of losing her mum at that age, because it's at that point life sort of started to spiral for Gemma. So she was able to do that letter with her peers and read it out and bury it and have a process around that. And I think that's been a real key thing for you, eh?
Yeah.
Doing that. Mm. Yeah.
Gemma, if you can, share us some details around your relationship with methamphetamine, because I understand you started using it at a very young age.
Yeah, so, like, my childhood was pretty good. Like, I had my mum and my dad. My sister did go to prison for 12 years. She got sentenced for 12 years. And after my mum died, I think it was 14 when I first picked up meth. And from then, I started using it every day, like, heavily. I started doing crime and lying to my family and stealing. And then I fell pregnant with my baby. Yeah, and I thought I, like, needed to change my life, so I stopped. And just last year, I picked up again and lost my baby again.
It must have been harrowing. But you've come a long way, though.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Are you proud of yourself?
Yeah, I'm very proud of myself. Yeah, so grateful for this program.
Did you, I mean, was there a time in your life where you would have struggled to foresee the progress that you've now made?
I'll say yes. Yep. Most of my life.
Is Gemma's story, Marie, something that you've become accustomed to hearing? Albeit we have our own unique story to tell, but is it very similar to others?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that we find with all those that come into the programs that we have here is that the similarity, of course, is the disorder, the addiction. I think what we've noticed with our wahine that come into Te Whare Tonga is that they're highly complex with a range of issues. you know, most of them have been through significant trauma and abuse in their life, have often been in the system themselves, intergenerational trauma, a lot of gangs, you know, intergenerational drug use and criminal behaviour right through whānaus. And a lot of family violence as well. We've found a lot of wahine that come through have experienced significant family violence with partners and things like that as well. So it's about learning to find their voice as well and their strength and mana as a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And having a safe space. You know, we have pregnant mum that come in before, and then they can have their baby, you know, give birth while they're there and just have that time with mama and Pepe where they can just care for their baby in a safe space without the stress of life. And, you know, that's very different for a lot of them. Some of them have had multiple children who may have been uplifted, so they've never had a chance to actually parent and be clean and sober when they're doing it. So, yeah, there's a lot of similarities. But, we've seen a lot of whānau relationships really restored in the program too, involving whānau, getting them on board, getting them to come in and be a part of it as well. So, yeah, I think they all have different stories but very similar as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I imagine too, Gemma, that it took some courage from you and some bravery to join the program and to jump into the unknown.
Yeah, I just really wanted my baby back. Like, you know, I was a mess when I lost her the second time. She had ended up in hospital and nearly died. And I knew, like, that was my turning point, and I needed to, like, be a prison mother for her and also to turn my life around and, you know, be there for her. Like, I was always there for her, but she wasn't getting my time. Like, she had everything, she just didn't have my time, and that was the most important thing.
Yeah, as a parent, it is, isn't it?
Yep.
It is. You just, kids don't want for much, do they? They just want a loving bond with their mum and their dad, really, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, mum.
Yeah. Mum's always the favourite. I know that. Hey, Marie, it's really nice to have you both on our program, and thanks for sharing your stories. Marie, let's talk about stigma. How hard is it for the wahine of New Zealand who are experiencing troubles like what Gemma had been through to come forward to get the help with also the fear that their babies may be taken away?
Well, I think it's very difficult. You know, I've worked at Higher Ground. This is my 12th year. My previous job, I managed the community team, which is our admissions team. And, you know, we always have less women in treatment than men. That's always been the case. So we might have 25 men in treatment, but we'll have 10 women. And I think it's harder for women in lots of areas to access treatment because of being mums. And, you know, there is still a stigma, sadly, out there. You know, I'm in recovery myself and a mum too. And, you know, I'm 15 years clean and sober now, but I know in those early stages there's a lot of shame and stigma around it. I think in our recovery community and our 12-step fellowships, we're proud of our achievements and to say, you know, kia ora, I'm Marie and I'm an addict, and be proud of that with your own people. But out in society, I think there's a lot of shame and fear and stigma, especially around methamphetamine. Yeah, it is a scourge of society and it's an evil drug, but I think addiction is a disease. That's how we look at it. You know, it's the same as somebody else having another disease and getting treatment. So we look at it in that way, you know. And sometimes people are really powerless over this disease. They may want to stop. Oh, why can't you just stop? You should be able to just stop. It's not that easy, you know. So I think more and more as we go along, society is getting more open to it and understanding that, you know, drugs are a health issue. So I'd like to think we're moving in a different direction with that. But I do think for mums, if the fear is that they will lose custody of their child, or even the ones that want to come in, who can I leave my child with so I can get well and access treatment, especially if the whole whānau's using, you know, like it's really difficult for mums to walk away and make sure that their babies are safe so that they can come into treatment. So I think having this program is really filling that gap as well in terms of stigma. So my hope, you know, we've only been going for a year, so my hope is that we can keep going as a pilot so that we can open up more for women everywhere to access it. Yeah.
Have you made some new friends, Gemma?
Yeah, I've made heaps.
Tell us about them.
I know a lot of people in recovery now, and yeah, I've got a lot of friends too that are all clean and wanting the right thing, so I'm happy.
Yeah. Tell us what happiness means to you.
Like, you know, going out and doing normal things, not having to, like, worry about the next use or, like, blocking your emotions out from using drugs. It's just, like, all normal. That's really good.
Were you worried or scared to come forward and seek help earlier because of the fact that drug use is seen as a criminal issue in New Zealand and you were worried about what the police might do?
To be honest, no, I wasn't. It was more of I didn't want to lose my baby, and I've been, like, using meth to, like, block my emotions. The main one was losing my mum. I didn't want to grieve, like, and it helped me. And as soon as I got clean, like, I was completely the opposite. Like, I was feeling all my emotions and stuff.
Yeah. I guess, Marie, as long as New Zealand treats drug use as a criminal issue, we can't move as quickly as we'd like, can we? That's how it seems to me anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I do get there's a lot of criminal activity that needs to be addressed and stopped for sure by the police. I fully understand that. But I see a lot more people now that end up with criminal convictions from the use of methamphetamine and other drugs, alcohol as well. You know, I do like the idea of the drug court giving people an opportunity to access treatment rather than prison. You know, like, I do think we are moving in a better direction. But yeah, there's still a lot of work to be done in that area for sure. Yeah.
What would you like to, what's your vision, Marie, for this lovely little program that you've cultivated and that you've poured a lot of time and care and emotion into? Where do you want to see it go?
Yeah, well, I think it's not just me. There's a big crew of us that spent a lot of time planning. You know, our board of trustees spent a long time planning this idea, and then we put it into action. I think we'd all like to see it continue. I'd like to see it open up as well to, because we're just catching the Auckland area mostly. So I'd like to see it open up nationwide. You know, continuous funding so that it can keep going and expand it even more. Like, we bought a whare, which is a great whare up the road. You know, it's close to our main facility, but it's not a purpose-built facility. I think it works really well for what we're doing, but I think in the future we'd love to kind of expand it and really go for it, you know, and make it really successful, because it is quite unique what we're doing.
Yeah. And what sort of support are you able to offer Gemma and for other women who leave the whare when they're ready?
And we've got quite a strong continuing care program at Higher Ground. So we have a community team who works with the pre-treatment clients, but also the ones that complete the program. So we have a couple of support houses, and we've opened our first support house for women only. So we've got one of the graduates in there already and one of the graduates from our main program, and then Pepe. So all going well for Gemma. She'll be going in there soon. She can stay there for a minimum of 6 months. And what that does is she'll still be under the guidance of Higher Ground, you know, and attending the continuing care program, which is groups and one-to-one counselling. Everyone's clean and sober. It's a safe place connected to here for her as she transitions back into, you know, getting her own place and getting things established for her and her Pepe. Yeah, so I think that's been going really well. Yeah. Because I think just going back to your own place and the stress of all of that, you know, I think it's a really good transition to leave the structure of residential treatment and go into the next phase, which is living independently but with our guidance and support.
And Gemma, what are your hopes and aspirations for yourself and your little one?
My hopes is to stay clean, stay connected, and to be a present mother for her, and just be happy. Yeah.
It's so important, isn't it, to want to be happy?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you want to do with your life now?
Definitely not turn back. I want to keep moving forward and get my own house and get a job. Yeah. And just be there for my baby.
Well, look, we wish you all the very best. We wish you nothing but good luck and good fortune, and well done too on coming through the program and being one of the first to graduate. And we wish you all the very best with everything.
Thank you.
And Marie, thank you very much for your time to talk to us today. And please keep up the great, tremendous work that you're doing. It's just so needed, and we're very grateful for that. Take it from us, as we always do every week before we wrap things up and head off. We give our Sheldon shout out to someone worthy. Karen, who is it this week?
Hi. Well, I had a quick message from a chap called Ali. He's been listening to the show. He says he loves the show and wants to give a shout-out. I said, yes, please. Who's it for? And he said it's to my partner, Roxy. She's doing so well, working really hard to give up the alcohol. She made a decision to give up the alcohol, and she's going really well. And he just wanted to give her a sort of pat on the back and say, he's got your back.
Nice.
He's got her back.
Yeah, and good work, Ali, and nice to know that Roxy has someone in her corner, and we wish you all the very best, Roxy, with that. Yeah, brave decision to have to make. Thanks, Karen, for producing our program for another week. Thank you so much for listening. Our special guests this week have been AJ Crawshaw and Marie Matthews and Gemma. Our brave young woman is Gemma, and she's doing really well too. So thanks to everyone who's joined our program. Thanks to Karen again. And we'll talk to you again next week on Take It From Us. Please check out our website, of course. Leave us a note, tifuradio.org, tifuradio.org. And we'll talk to you again very, very soon.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us.
the sky.